All right, so we got to start approximately on time so the people will get here approximately on time.
You know, the trick is take the bus and you're here on time. That's what I do.
If the bus is on time.
No, the bus is on time.
Okay. Okay, so let's see. A few announcements. Let's see. First announcement about Mind and Supermind. There is no Mind and Supermind in November. We talked about that last week. But there are two Mind and Superminds for the spring session. And I can talk about them very briefly. I'll tell you more about them as time goes on. First one is on February 27th. And it's Jim Fadiman, who is one of the founders of transpersonal psychology. I'm going to talk about some interesting and provocative stuff. Two things, apparently he's going to talk about two things. He's going to talk about the idea that that your personality is not one personality, but that there are actually multiple selves in there. And the second thing he's going to talk about is microdosing, which is this big buzz that's happening that has to do with the fact that psychedelics are neurotransmitter agonists. That is, they help neurotransmitter functioning. They kind of mimic neurotransmitter functioning. And in very small doses, they seem to have something to do with better focus, more ability to concentrate for longer, and greater creativity.
And more color.
What? And more color. So the point is, he's going to talk about that. He's kind of the world expert on that right now. He's an extremely interesting guy, a brilliant guy, so it'll be fun to listen.
What's his last name?
Fadiman. He founded the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology. F-A-D-I-M-A-N. Fadiman. James Fadiman.
Is it in our catalog?
It will be in the catalog, yeah. So that's February 27th. And then May 8th, Rick Tarnas comes back. Yeah, he's the most brilliant and amazing.
Oh, wow.
And it's going to be in here, so there's going to be 150 people. Register for it immediately, please. Okay, so Rick Fadiman is going to talk. He's just going to talk about everything. And he says, Rick, why don't you give us the whole deal? And so he's talking about humanity's rite of passage. He's saying, what's happening in the world? What does it indicate for human existence? Because Rick doesn't do the small stuff. Okay, he's the guy that wrote The Passion of the Western Mind, the most common textbook for introductory philosophy in the world. He's an extraordinary human being. And so,
May 8th.
What?
I'm sorry, when did the tickets go on sale?
Whenever, I don't know, whenever the spring semester becomes available, we're going to do Adventures in Awareness, which is this class with a different title, Progress, because I just wanted a different title. So that class runs 8 weeks, so you get one free week. It's still $69, but you get an extra week for nothing.
Oh, $69 this time?
Just like it was this time. If you need scholarships, there are scholarships available. You check in the office. And that starts, I think, January 20th and runs through March 17th.
I think Darren Tony's got money. That's Martin Luther King birthday, isn't it?
Say again?
Darren Tony's got money. That's Martin Luther King's birthday, isn't it? No, January 20th.
I don't know. I'm not sure that it starts then, but I think it does, Julie. Okay, so let's do some, join.
I just returned a Jimmy pilgrimage to Bhutan, and so when he was there, he collected some Buddhists from each monastery he visited. This is for you. Bhutanese dirt inside from all of the monasteries, and then he broke down each one. He went to the tiger's nest.
Treasure!
So,
yeah. Thank you!
He'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. So Dick has not only given me dirt from every monastery of Bhutan, Dick has also given me a leaf from the Bodhi tree, which is sitting on my altar. Yeah. Thank you again. Okay. I don't get to go, but I get this vicariously.
Thank you. Okay, so we got to do
a little city. I know that in these 10 minutes, it's really difficult to do anything except come out of thought eventually and find your breathing and begin to relax. So I realize that what I'm telling you is theoretic rather than actual. But it would be nice if you tried the following thing in your sitting. Again, just 10 minutes, I just ring the bell, I'm not going to, my voice doesn't die, you can do it by yourself. The most common mistake is to think you're being mindful. The way you, it's not substitution of one thought for another, okay? It's not that. So you have to take your attention and bring it from your thoughts to something else, your breathing, and just keep coming back to your breathing. That's the bottom line. And when you do that, after a while, your experience opens up in front of you. So you can notice your thoughts, your feelings, and sensations as they happen. Stay aware of the breathing, or else you get caught up in those things. So, as you open this witnessing perspective, this ability to watch your experience, then I would suggest today feeling this perspective expanding in all directions and all dimensions without limit. That is, your sense of edge, me, goes away, and your awareness opens, not only all these ways, but also this way. So there's a depth to it. So it becomes an infinitely large capacity to notice. And in that capacity to notice, you have whatever experiences you have without trying to understand them. Without trying to label, this is that. Just pure experience. So you're an infinite universe of awareness in which there is just pure experience. So you allow anything from any level to be experienced.
Why don't we try that for 10 minutes, okay?
Turn these off, right?
Oh, yes. Please, so we don't have to experience too much from the cyberspace level. Why don't you turn your phones off, or at least to whatever their quiet modes are, okay? So
I gotta turn the lights off. So here goes. When the bell rings.
again. That was very nice. And, maybe in one of my sessions we will go a lot longer because as you quiet down and as you become more aware of your breathing, you become more able to have experience and you become more able to have various levels of experience. And that takes a while because usually you're caught up in what's happening on the surface and there's a lot of agitation. So it takes a while for the body to calm down and the mind to calm down and open up. And when you do this in a group, it helps you to stay aware of your breathing, and the kind of the group feeling helps you to kind of open more completely. So maybe in the winter we'll take one session and do a longer sit.
Okay.
This morning's session is going to have two parts to it. I'm going to talk for a while, and I'm going to introduce a special guest who's going to present a little further. So, we're talking about the sixth area of aliveness, which roughly corresponds to the sixth chakra. Remember, I take liberties so that I can organize it in my way. So this sixth area, in my view, has to do with the forehead, the eyes, the ears, and also perhaps the third eye, and the brain. And it seems to have two levels to it, or two parts to it, a part that has to do with intelligence, and the part that has to do with intuition. And these may or may not correspond roughly to the two hemispheres of the brain, the left hemisphere being the analytic one, and the right one being the more holistic one. And possibly this area has to do with not only opening the mind, but opening a deeper level of mind, a third eye level. But we'll talk about that. Okay, so I'm going to talk now about this more familiar level. That is the level of your intelligence. Remember the metaphor of the flowering tree? Now we're at the level of fruition, which is the level at which the human being is the fullest being it can be, still encased in a body. And if you have an open mind, you see the world not only from your perspective, but because of other people's experience and your interaction with other people, you see the world from their perspective. So when you listen to somebody and you don't say lost in your, you know, caught in your own thoughts, but you listen to them and you listen mindfully, you know, without judgment, just sharing their experience, you gain a whole different view of what the world looks like. And so if you practice opening your mind and listening fully without trying to translate it into your own terms, then you just broaden and broaden and broaden, because everybody that you come into contact with and you talk to enriches your perspective or gives you a larger perspective. So you see the world from many, 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 many different eyes. Also, there's all the creative representations that people have made. Paintings that they've painted, the books they've written, the stuff you see on the media, all of which give you an enlarged view of the world. So when the mind is open, you go beyond your own perspective. And you increasingly see the world from a multiplicity of perspectives. And that gives you a broader sense of what the world is. If you don't stay stuck in your own, this is right, this is wrong, I only see it this way, I only translate it into my own terms. When you do this, when you practice listening mindfully and opening your mind to really experience other people's perspectives, then you realize that the world is not—it's a more complex place than you had formerly understood. That is, that there are many different answers to things based on many different sets of assumptions. And each person has a slightly different set of assumptions, so comes to slightly different conclusions. And the societal problems that we face, our tendency is to want to get one right answer based on what we understand. We want a reason to, this is the way to fix that. But that's a kind of a 20th century solution. The idea that you get rid of all the wrong answers and you finally come to the one right answer, that's called modern thought. But postmodern thought has to do with the fact that there's no one right answer. That every perspective on the world is an approximation of something that is beyond our intellectual analysis. So if you want to get the best answer for any problem, you look at all the perspectives and you realize that the sum total of all the perspectives gives you a better approximation for something beyond understanding than any one perspective gives you. That's called postmodernism, right? The idea that the multiplicity of perspectives gives you a richer understanding than each individual perspective does. And for these complex problems, they're complex. That's the thing that people have to understand, is that they're not going to be solved by abracadabra, by I'll change this or I'll do this. It's going to be, has to be an effort that has to do with understanding all the variables and all the ways that they interact. And that only comes when you grace all the positions, when you understand all the positions or include all the positions. We have a tendency in our minds to come to premature closure. It's safer. It's more secure to think, oh, that's the answer. It makes you feel less threatened. But remember what Maslow said about self-actualizing people? He said they're different than normal people because they gravitate toward the disorderly, the not yet formed, the unknown. They open to the complexity of things rather than trying to reduce the complexity of things to safety. So in our own minds, we have to kind of become tolerant of don't know, of let me gather more information and not try to kind of prematurely say, oh, I got it. This is a tiny aside, but I once had a session with a famous Zen master, and he asked a riddle, you know, koan, and I thought about it for a little bit, and I thought, and he asked, you know, what's the answer to this? And I said, I don't know. And he said, very good. He said, only keep dono mind, you'll be enlightened. And I thought that was brilliant. Oh, you just kind of keep your mind open. That's, you know. So I thought it was so special that he got me that way. But then I talked to a lot of other people who had the session, and the same, he asked the same question, and they gave the same answer, and he gave me the same response. So. True story. Okay, so if you are willing to broaden your mind, to adopt other people's positions, to see the world from the multiplicity of positions, and realize the complexity of things, then it is possible to develop wisdom. So that seems to me to be the fruition of the intellect, is being wise. Okay, not just having more information, but something beyond that. So there is no, in psychology, there's no good definition of wisdom. I keep reading these different theories of wisdom and I think they stink. I shouldn't have said that. They're less than fully adequate. So I thought that I would come up with my own definition of wisdom because the ground is valid. And so what I think wisdom is it's two things. I think it's kind of the broadest, having the most information, and the realization of how complex and how many variables there are, and how complex a fashion they interact. So the person that has kind of the broadest view, but that's not enough. Also, the person that has the clearest understanding of what would be effective action. So the broadest view, but also the most clear perception of the best way forward. So I call this extent and essence. I think the wise mind understands the extent of things and also the essence of things.
Yes.
So how to proceed.
Yes.
Okay. That's just my top definition. Okay. Chris?
Isn't there a certain spiritual maturity involved at the base of it? Because if they're full of neurosis, they're never going to get there.
If they're full of neuroses, they're stuck to themselves. One way to look at neurosis is you try to figure it out in your own position. You know, so this is the opposite of this. This is being so healthy, like Maslow says, that you can adopt everybody's position and see the validity in that, and realize that this whole thing is not it's a dynamic system.
But isn't the condition have a certain emotional and slash spiritual maturity?
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise you can't do that. If you're not emotionally mature, you can't open this way. You're not brave enough to open this way. Okay, so I wrote this last evening, so I wouldn't have good words for it. Okay. The wise person gathers more information. Let's say, okay, now I got it because I read that. But gathers all the information, or all the information possible. Second, sees more patterns and interactions in that information. Complexity. And third, discerns the most effective way to proceed. So again, it's extent and essence.
Would you repeat those three?
Yeah. The wise person gathers more information, sees more patterns and interactions, and discerns the most effective way to proceed. Okay, so what if you don't feel, Jay?
Well, I think one of the things I've observed after 80 years is that things like religion and politics are dogmas, they're systems of control, and, you know, they tell you the right way, and there's a lot of different.
Right, so the idea would be to understand each of those understandings, but not to be restricted into each of those. Okay. All right, so what if you don't feel capable of opening your mind in this way? You feel like, I'm not smart enough to understand the complexity of things and really deep things and quantum physics and how to forecast the weather and economic systems. You know, what if you don't feel like you're smart enough? Then you remember what Carol Dweck said, right? Carol Dweck is the person that talked about fixed mindset versus growth mindset. And she said, the mind is like a muscle. If you use it, it gets stronger. And so the idea is not to think I don't have that capacity, but rather that I haven't developed that capacity. They taught me in school that they didn't have that capacity. That's called fixed mindset. Instead of teaching me that with effort and good intention, I could develop that capacity. So it turns out that we used to think that intelligence was fixed at birth, genetically given, and there's more and more evidence that intelligence is modifiable, even on IQ tests, which are a very narrow definition of intelligence. But because now we think of intelligence as being multiple intelligences, there are all kinds of ways that the brain can work better than it currently works. It rewires itself every moment, you know. So the idea, instead of thinking that I don't have that capacity, is to think, I didn't know that I had that capacity, but now that I know that I have that capacity, I can develop that capacity. And it's all right to be confused. And it's all right to ask questions like, I don't understand that, you know, tell me more about that. That's how the capacity grows. Michael, and then we've got to keep moving quickly.
Okay, it was Carol Burnett who used to say at the end of each of her shows, it seems that we just get started and it's time to say so long. And it was one thing I experienced with my mom's life toward the end of her life. It seems she got so much maturity and wisdom. And when she seemed to recognize that and feel super comfortable in everything, it was time to go. And I've seen this a number of times.
Maybe you go from the sixth to the seventh and you go like that. Okay, so a good way to become more intellectually able is to hang around people who are alive in that way, intellectually alive. And it kind of rubs off, you know, they kind of see that they, when they don't know something, they just kind of wade into it. And they kind of, you know, blunder their way through it, and they watch how they operate, and you think, well, I could do that, too. I could blunder into something like that. So it kind of rubs off on you. So you hang around, if you hang around people that are, whose minds are growing and alive, then it helps you to feel that way, and it helps you to adopt that kind of attitude. And when you hang around such people, you ask a lot of questions. How do you learn that? What does that really mean? And that helps that process open. So, homework. Two possibilities. One, and suggested homework. First, investigate something appealing but abstruse. Abstruse means not easy to understand. Okay? Something appealing but not easy to understand. I really, you know, I've often been curious about, but it seems so difficult, you know. Why don't I kind of like wiki it a little bit and, you know, go over here and blunder around and see if I can kind of shed a little light on this thing that I've always wanted to know that seems too difficult for me to know. So, wade into something. Okay. That you've always wanted to know that you feel like you can't figure out or it's too difficult. And see how it evolves. Okay. Second, harder one. Listen with a fully open mind.
Next debate.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was just going to say. So you have to listen. You have to realize that, look, unless a person is entirely insane, and that may be the case. But
then you believe this.
Unless a person is really, something is really wrong with them, they have some assumptions, and they reason validly from those assumptions to whatever conclusion they come to. Okay, so if you take the other person's assumptions on, you see how they come to their conclusions, and you realize that we're all coming from the same basic needs, and we're just coming up with different strategies based on the different assumptions we have, the different information we have. And so if you listen with an open mind, you really realize how valid points of view that are different than yours are. Not that you're going to go with that point of view, but you realize the validity of that point of view. So you bow to everybody. And you talk to everybody about the best strategy in this situation. But you realize that everybody is trying to get to the same end, which is health and happiness, you know. Carl, and then we got to go.
Yeah, if you make the assumption that people operate from a position of goodwill, and
there
are a number of people, particularly in the higher echelons of our society, that don't operate from a position of goodwill, or operating from a position of power seeking and self service. So that assumption of logical reasoning from different assumptions doesn't really...
Yeah, it does. I'm going to respond to that. I think it does. I think that they're operating from... They're validly reasoning from their assumptions to their conclusions, The reasoning process is good, but their assumptions are assumptions about the way that they can get their basic needs met. That so they're thinking, I got to be secure, to be happy, I have to have this kind of control. Okay. I want to talk to that person about the idea that strategy is going to lead not to them being more secure, but to social unrest and for them to be insecure. So their assumptions are leading them to their conclusions. That's valid, but I'm going to debate with them about whether what they think is going to happen, given their assumptions and their conclusions, is really going to happen. Understand? I think everybody that's capable of thinking is trying to get needs met. It's just a bad strategy.
Right, but it may not have anything to do with the needs of the wider society.
No, I'm going to talk about their needs. So they're going to say, I want to get my needs met by controlling everybody. And I'm going to say, that's not a good way to get your needs met, because it's called revolution in the future. So I'm going to debate them about...
Because that's not what we're talking about.
Okay, anyway, let's... go. The point about this is... But we'll go on and talk about it later. I got to go on, folks. I can't take any more comments, okay? Okay, I got to read you something to introduce our guest speaker. This is from a book called Paths Beyond Ego, a book about transpersonal psychology by Roger Walsh and Francis Vaughn. They edited this book. It's kind of the all-star game of... transpersonal psychology. And I'm going to read you just a little section here called Hidden Wisdom. This is by Roger Walsh. Some of you know Roger because he's spoken to Mind Supermind several times. He's an MD, PhD, University of California, Irvine, absolutely brilliant person. Wrote an amazing book on shamanism, amongst other things. Okay, so Hidden Wisdom. Western philosophers usually assume that intellectual training and analysis alone provide the royal road to understanding. That is, intellect provides the royal road to understanding. However, transpersonal philosophers, especially those of Asian traditions such as Vedanta, Sankhya, Buddhism, and Taoism, think differently. They emphasize that while intellectual training is necessary, by itself it's not sufficient for deep understanding. They claim that the mind must also be given a multidimensional, contemplative, or yogic training that refines ethics, emotions, motivation, and attention. They say there's something else besides intellectual training necessary. This training is designed to develop the eye of contemplation, by introducing specific states of consciousness in which one has the keenness, subtlety, and quickness of cognitive response that are required for penetrating insights into the nature of mind and reality. These insights collectively constitute the transcendental wisdom, variously known as prajna in Buddhism, jnana, Hinduism, marifa, Islam, or Gnosis, Christianity. This wisdom is the goal of contemplative training and is said to liberate those who acquire it from delusion and the suffering it produces. This wisdom is described as a direct, non-conceptual intuition that is beyond words, concepts, and dualities. Hence, it is described as transverbal, transrational, and non-dual. Quote, not by reasoning is this apprehension attainable, says the Upanishads. And according to the third Zen patriarch, to seek mind with a discriminating or logical mind is the greatest of all mistakes. It is a mistake because, in the words of the great Indian philosopher Radhakrishnan, the real transcends, surrounds, and overflows our miserable categories. The real transcends, surrounds, and overflows our miserable categories. Although intellectual analysis by itself is insufficient
to acquire or comprehend this wisdom, one can subsequently derive intellectual ideas, psychologies, and philosophies from this wisdom. Indeed, the perennial philosophy and the world's traditional transpersonal philosophies and psychologies probably were derived in just this way. Moreover, unless this wisdom is directly experienced in succeeding generations, traditions ossify into mere dogmas. That is the direct experience that he's talking about. When not re-experienced, becomes just rote. So contemplatives first train the eye of contemplation.
Wait, is that eye?
Oh, eye of contemplation. The eye. Yeah, the eye of contemplation is the, this, yeah.
Yeah, but it's both.
But it is both, yeah.
It's also eye.
Yeah, it also is, yeah.
Eye, eye.
Okay. Okay, so contemplatives first train the eye of contemplation in order to develop specific capacities and states of consciousness. Then they investigate, describe, and philosophize from the perspectives of both contemplative and ordinary states. This means that transpersonal philosophies and psychologies are multi-state systems. Significant parts of their knowledge may therefore be state-specific and comprehensible only to those who have themselves adequately trained their eye of contemplation. The result is that their insights cannot be judged by unenlightened people from the worm's eye view of book learning. For example, the idea that our sense of self, which we usually assume to be relatively stable and enduring, is actually constructed anew each moment out of a ceaseless flow of thoughts, images, and sensations, may be an interesting concept when we read about it. But when seen directly in meditation, it becomes undeniably clear, and by undercutting egocentricity, it can be life-changing and helpful. Aldous Huxley said, "Knowledge is a function of being. Without contemplative training, our being is not adequate for accessing such insights." According to the Buddhist economist E.F. Shoemaker, if we do not have the requisite organ or instrument, or fail to use it, we are not adequate to this particular part or facet of the world, with the result, as far as we're concerned, that it simply doesn't exist. If it is true that without an open eye of contemplation, we're not fully adequate to understand the deeper profundities of transpersonal philosophies and psychologies, then what aspects of them are lost to us, and how are we likely to respond to our truncated vision of them? Of transpersonal philosophies and psychologies. One common response is to simply dismiss them as nonsensical. In such cases, the entire wisdom of the traditions is lost to us. In other cases, the loss may be more insidious. But when we approach transpersonal disciplines without the requisite contemplative training, the more subtle, profound, state-specific depths tend to be overlooked. And what is critical to understanding is that we will not even recognize that we're overlooking these more profound depths of meaning. This occurs because the higher grades of significance are lost. The easiest way of illuminating this is by means of a classic example. An animal may see an oddly shaped black and white object. A tribal person might see a rectangular, flexible object with curious markings. A Western child might see a book. An adult might see a particular kind of book, namely a book that makes incomprehensible, even ridiculous claims about reality. And a physicist might see a profound text about quantum mechanics. Different views give you different outcomes, different understandings. What's important to see is that all the observers are partly correct in their characterization of the book. But all except the trained physicists are unaware how much more meaningful and significant the object is than they can recognize. And most important to the non-physicist, it's a book that seems incomprehensible and even ridiculous. What this example so nicely demonstrates is that when we cannot comprehend higher grades of significance, We blithely believe that we fully understood something whose true significance we've completely missed. This raises an arresting question. What higher grades of significance, what profound meanings and messages does the world give us that we're overlooking? It's said that to a sage, the leaves on the trees are like the pages of a sacred text filled with transcendent meaning. We don't see things only as they are, but also as we are. We don't see things only as they are, but also as we are. Contemplative training changes the way we are and opens us to the hidden wisdom and higher grades of significance in transpersonal traditions, in the world, and in ourselves.
Wait, can I read the last
sentence? Yeah, the last sentence.
Yeah, the last sentence, okay. Contemplative training, which we're about to hear, about which we're about to hear, contemplative training changes the way we are and opens us to the hidden wisdom and higher grades of significance in transpersonal traditions, in the world, and in ourselves. So this is Roger... So this is Roger Walsh, who is amazing, okay? And I will, in the winter, I'm going to be reading more from this book because it's remarkable. But I want to introduce our guest now. So instead of showing you something on the screen, I thought I would bring the paragon to you, okay? So this is Svetlana Merritt. Who is teaching a course starting on October 28th in this room at this time. So when our course ends on the 21st, and then she's teaching a three-session course starting on the 28th titled Sacred Spirits, excuse me, Sacred Sites Tracking Earth Spirit. Sacred Sites Tracking Earth Spirit. And it's for three Fridays from October 28th to November 18th. Here at this time. Okay. And I have asked her, out of my ignorance and out of her knowledge, to talk to us about opening the third eye, which is the deeper level of this area coming into play. Okay. So without further ado, it is my honor and pleasure to introduce Svetlana Merritt. And
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's so wonderful to be here in what, to me, as an outside observer who is here for the first time, felt like a family. It's such a closely knit group. It's just a joy to be actually talking here and being in this energy field. There were so many things that popped up in my mind while Spencer was talking, and trying to now recollect all those comments I wanted to make. But one that kind of really struck a chord with me was the multiplicity of perspectives, because all my life that has been pertinent thing for me in my development, because I have come across this situation very often in many different countries. People choose a certain way of looking at things and understanding things, and they get attached to it, and they kind of buy into it, and that becomes it. Everything else is that filter through that particular system of understanding life. And I always like to think out of the box and to entertain different possibilities. And my favorite quote is something that Socrates said 4,000 years ago. The more I know how much I don't know. And even though it kind of feels a little bit confusing when you hear it, really, as you expand your mind, you come to realize that there is so much more to learn. And then you become aware of how actually teeny tiny spot you are, particle in this vast universe of these amazing discoveries to be made. And so, along those lines, about 10 years ago, I have embarked on a journey of discovery with my then, actually my late husband and mentor. We left our life, we left our world as it is, and we embarked on a journey to India, Egypt, Cyprus, Italy, France, and we were looking for many things, you know, journeys. The purpose of journeys change, you know, you start with one idea, but then journeys have their own life and they take you on with them, and that purpose changes if you're open. And here we come again to the idea of the open mind. So what I'm going to talk about today, about the brow chakra and Ajna Center and third eye, all these words you see on the screen, or I hope you see on the screen. I wonder if it would be better if you turn off the
If you want, we can also pull those shades, so you can really, that's generally what we
do. Because this is a beautiful picture of the Buddha, but I'm afraid you cannot really make it out there.
Why don't we pull the drape so that you can really show that, yeah? Is that okay?
Perfect. Sure.
Yeah, well let's, That's that one, so this must be this one.
Keep it on.
Can you put it behind you? There we go.
Thank you. I spent a lot of time choosing just the right pictures for these presentations. It would be a shame not to see them. Thank you. Sorry about the confusion. So, the topic of chakras, or energy centers in the body, is one that is not easily understood in the objective sense of the word. Because chakras are not visible, they're not in the body, they're energy centers. So how do we get information on chakras? Because we can't see them. Well, we have a body of literature coming from the East, mostly India, dating back 4,000, 6,000 years ago, that gives us detailed information on chakras, which by the way means wheel in Sanskrit, with all sorts of diagrams, particular exercises, and so forth. And we also have a body of knowledge from, let's say, evolved human beings in the West who had psychic vision or clairvoyance and could see the chakras and could then tell us about it. So we can take their word, or we can explore on our own, or we can combine. So we have different ways of approaching it. But my point here being is multiplicity of perspectives. So what I'm going to talk about today is not the only correct information. If you pick up different books, you'll find different information. So there is a lot of actually disagreement. There's a lot of different connections between chakras and the physical organs, chakras and the glands. So I come from the Western tradition. I'm not really on the Oriental path. And all my teachers who were in incarnation, were also on the Western path. So I just wanted you to know where I come from. But I have included also some information from Indian literature. So Brown Chakra, Ajna Center, these are various terms used to describe the sixth chakra, as well as the third eye. You're probably familiar with this diagram, the human body with the energy centers. And right here is the third eye, or the Ajna Center. I'm going to explain the difference between the two terms. And as you can see, they look like a funnel, like vortices, little vortices. And the teachers say that they connect into the spine from the back, and they pass through the body, and then they radiate out in front. In the esoteric healing, which I have done, I'm training for some time, the teachers say that the back part is the mental aspect of the chakras, the front part is the emotional aspect of the chakras. So if you're working on a patient, on a client, and there's some mental issues to address, you approach them from the back. If you are working on emotional issues, then you're working on the front of the chakras. And each chakra has several levels. You know, chakras are energy centers. They pass, they're actually receptors, instruments of reception and transmission. That's what chakras are. We receive energy, we transmit energy. So, Ajna is Brow Chakra, is located between the eyes, slightly above the eyes, and it's actually the synthesis of the personality. It's the chakra that synthesizes all the other chakras from the bottom up. So in that sense, it's a very important energy center. Because as a human being, we have a lot of bits and pieces. We are made of, first of all, physical dense body, then the layer of the etheric body, then another layer of the emotional body, then another layer of the mental body, and then another layer of the spiritual body. So we're very, very complex. Add to that we have different sub-personalities. You know, famous psychologist Roberto Saggioli, who developed the system of psychosynthesis, he said we all have sub-personalities. He said we have five, and they all come out at different times, depending on the situation that triggers it, depending on the people who trigger it. So in one moment, a person can say one thing and completely mean it. And then the next moment, forget that he ever said that. And that's because another subpersonality comes into play. So the point of the sixth chakra is to integrate all those personalities, is to synthesize all our bodies, to bring the energies of all the lower chakras and have them all right here. And why is that important? Because only as an integrated personality can we open and make a contact with our soul, or higher self, or our essence, however you want to call it. And then, as we are open to the soul contact, the third eye develops. So it doesn't come, it's there, but it has to be developed. And the third eye, we can talk about it as a psychic organ of the ajna. And think about it in the terms like our eyes. Our eyes are the tools of perception for our brain. So the third eye is the organ of inner seeing for the ajna center. Is that clear? More or less, we'll discuss it further. So, when I talk about all these different terms, I just want to show you the symbols. This is a Hindu symbol, circle with two wings, inverted triangle, and the Om sign in the middle. And we'll talk about the meaning of these two wings. This is a Buddhist symbol for the third eye or ajna, and this is Egyptian, the eye of Horus. And this is a psychic representation of the third eye. I don't know if you can tell the difference in colors. It's different because I had scanned it. So this, there are two halves. Can you see two halves?
Yeah.
So on the right side is more like pinkish in color with golden hues. The left side is supposed to be more purple. But you see the distinct division in two. So there are two halves. And then there are all these tiny little fragments in each half. So this is an illustration done by a German mystic in 1696, and this is how he saw the third eye. And we talk about the third eye having two parts, two halves, or two petals. Each petal is made of 48 little fragments or spokes, if we think of chakras as a wheel. And 2 times 48 is 96. Now, what do these numbers mean? I'm not very much into numerology, but sometimes numbers are revealing. So this is the chart of all the chakras as lotus symbols in Hindu teachings. The first chakra has 4 petals, the chakra number 2 has 6, that's 10, third chakra 10, that's 20, heart chakra has 12, that's 42, and throat chakra 16, that's 48. So when we synthesize all of these lower 5 chakras into the 6th chakra, we have 48 petals in one half, 48 in the other, which means that there are two aspects, like yin and yang, male and female, to all these petals. And the two wings of the 6th chakra also relate to any recognition? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sales. Or the symbol of medicine. The staff that God Mercury carries, and God Mercury has to wings. So to go back to this slide, there are three major energy channels in the body, which the Hindus call nadis. So they transport prana through the body. And they go up the spine. And there's the middle part, which is called Shushumna. There is the left one, which on the picture is right. The white one, which is female, yin, or moon aspect of it, which is called Ida. And the right one is red, honey red, and masculine, solar, and it's called Pingala. They meet right here in the brow chakra. And you can see the two wings. So there are many ways in which this symbolism can be understood, you know. But this is the path of the energy up the body. And there it is, in the forehead, in the sixth chakra, in the ajna. So, Spencer mentioned opening, you know, opening of the mind, opening of the mind, opening of the chakras. I hesitate to talk about opening of the chakras because from every teacher I've had in my life, I've heard the warnings. Don't mess with it. It comes naturally. What is important is you cultivate virtues. You work on becoming a better person. You expand your consciousness. You do selfless service. And all of that will make a shift in your energy. And that shift in energy will open the chakras. So it will happen naturally when it's time, not when you will it and you force it. Of course, the Indians had a different approach to it. They had designed a whole set of exercises to meditate on each chakra specifically to force them open. But you know what? Unless you have a really, really good teacher who knows what he or she's doing, it's a dangerous business. And there have been many casualties along that way. The energy is the powerful thing. We don't know what we carry in us. We're totally ignorant of all the ramifications and consequences that can be produced if you try to forcefully manipulate the centers of energy before you're ready in your consciousness. The consciousness has to be ready. The form follows. That is always a rule of thumb whenever you are on the spiritual path. So the teachers say that this is the seat of that famous Kundalini, and as Kundalini goes up, the spine and the pathways intertwine, intersect, and vivify the chakras along. There are certain, how would I call them, protective mechanisms that are placed between the chakras in the form of web, etheric web. And they prevent accidental opening of the chakras when we're not ready. So that etheric web is dissolved as we shift our energy up, as we expand in awareness. And that web disintegrates on its own. And the energy then goes up and vivifies the center in the forehead. So let's see some symbols and correspondences. I already mentioned that in Sanskrit, Ajna is the name of the sixth chakra, which means to perceive. So we're talking about the element of light and the function, first of all, as the center of the integrated personality, and second, the organ of sight, both outer and inner. So the sixth chakra has to do with seeing, as I said, outer, as well as inner, which is intuition. The inner sight is your intuition. Visions, imagination, and clairvoyance. So this is all function of the sixth chakra. And you see this second word here, what it means to command. It refers to actually the second part of the development of the sixth chakra. So first you integrate your personality, so you act as one, not as five different people who live inside of you. And then you can receive the soul contact, the light of the soul, and you can direct it. You can command your reality then. You become the creator of your reality, but only when you are integrated. So all of you wants to do the same thing, which is to be a soul, to merge with a soul, to live according to higher values. And then all this, you know, powers and abilities like clairvoyance will come naturally. Of course, some people already have that, they're born with it for various purposes, because they're so, you know, our souls have different purposes, why, what they want us to do when we're in the body. Sixth chakra is related to the pituitary gland. That is its touchdown point in the body. And the pituitary is the master gland. It organizes and directs all the other glands. And pituitary, if you may know, has two parts, posterior and anterior. And there we are again. Two halves of the chakra, two petals, lotus petals. So we have this double, the number two interwoven through this chakra. Body parts that are associated and governed by this center are eyes, central nervous system, nose, and cerebellum, or the lower brain. The color is indigo. Petals, we already seen that. Metal is silver. Gemstones are lapis and quartz. And here is the diagram of the brain, and here is the pituitary gland. So the ajna is right here, and the touchdown point of the chakra is the pituitary. And here is pineal, which is related to the crown chakra. So the third eye actually is developed when these two glands are enter into mutual communication, let's put it that way. It's like a bar magnet, the pole, minus and plus pole. So the pineal gland provides the plus pole, the pituitary minus, they enter into communication, the electromagnetic field is created right in the middle of our brain, and that's when the third eye is developed. Any questions so far? The darkness is very conducive to dozing off.
they often say that at menopause, the brain rewires, and that there is hopefully the outcome is of greater wisdom. So maybe there is a connection between the change in life and developing the connection between the pituitary and the pineal gland, which.
You know, from the recent research in neuroscience, brain rewires all the time. And we can rewire it on our own, absolutely any minute.
Mm-hmm. But could it be that nature has built in a clock to accomplish this if it hasn't happened?
Nature has built in many clocks in our body, yes, absolutely. We miss a clock, we miss that window of opportunity to develop one function of us as human beings. The question is whether at menopause, the pituitary and pineal...
Well, that this process is hardwired in us and wants to happen, and maybe menopause is the time when it is facilitated, if it hasn't happened before.
What about men?
Oh, I don't know about guys. I just felt a major change, and there was a kind of a way I didn't want to deal anymore with the providing, and there was a real pull towards going.
Well, you know, there's so many changes happening at menopause for simple reason because all the hormones change. But whether that is really the rewiring of the pineal and pituitary, I haven't come across that, you know. I don't see why it would happen at menopause. It can happen at any time. It depends on our own intention and where we focus our efforts. Sometimes it can coincide, because that's when we start to question things, because so many things change and our bodies change and moods and emotions and life situation, and we start questioning things. You know, we don't question things while we're happy. That's the problem. That's why we have to go through so much pain and suffering, because that's like our wake-up call, and we start wondering, gosh, what is this life about? When we're happy, you know, we don't tend to ask questions, unfortunately. Yes.
I'm 57 years old next week or 3 weeks from now, and maybe it might be menopause. I have noticed my testosterone levels dropping, like I think most people do, most men. And for me, it's been a real blessing because I came on this planet with a lot of extra stuff in that area, and it really
extra testosterone.
Oh yeah, so and the chemicals that create distractions and all things, you know, around sexuality, sensuality, these things had a lot of issues, a lot of joy, but it's been a real refreshing thing for me to have these things drop the intensity so that my mind can open the wisdom that we spoke of earlier, the maturing process. I'm feeling it as that. I'm not as full and attached to things as much as I used to be.
Well, you know, in the Ecclesiastes, it says there is time for everything. So it's no coincidence that at 20 and 30 we have all these hormones rushing, and our attention is all to the physical body and matter and sex and procreation and whatnot. And then comes this middle part of our lives when everything quiets down so that we can direct our attention to the spiritual parts of ourselves, to the mind, to what Spencer was talking about, opening the mind.
Mm-hmm. Should we, if you have more slides, I put the lights on?
Yeah, I couldn't see
them.
We have about three.
Yes, I just want to quickly go on to the next slide just to show you what the Western teachers are now, how they think of chakras as energy vortices rather than petals. So we're kind of revising our knowledge about centers, and we think of them more as funnels or vortices that enter the body, rather than the symbols of lotuses that has been used for several thousand years ago in the in India and in the East. So yes, I can take a few more questions because this is the last slide, and we can open the curtains.
How do we know that that's the shape?
How do we know that?
That's
the shape.
Yeah.
As I said, teachers who have clairvoyance, who are working with energy bodies, they have represented them in that way, so we can take our word for them, or we can research new discoveries in quantum physics and the way they are seeing the matter in the universe existing in the shape of vortices. So wherever there is atomic activity, it happens as a spiral. It's everything in the universe existing as a spiral. Yes?
We're not really allowed to talk about the Kundalini or the first chakra in our society, but I was wondering, I noticed it's anatomically misplaced, and the other photo you had, it shows on the ankles, and just wondering, do you have anything?
You know, one of my teachers, esoteric healing teacher from London, she said, it's the outdated notion that we have to raise Kundalini. Actually, Kundalini is raised. It is us who have to rise up to her.
Right.
Yes.
You mentioned that we don't think about things when they are good, but we tell ourselves this will pass. It'll always be the same. In other words, if it's good, we appreciate it, but we know it'll pass. If it's bad, we can deal with it, because we know it'll pass. But my question to you is, if the brain is constantly rewiring, how does that affect cognitive impairment, et cetera, like dementia or whatever, if one can recreate the wiring in the brain constantly?
You know, I have just been doing a very, very new system called limbic retraining, because I don't want to be a puppet of my subconscious emotions. And mark my word, 95% of your thoughts and feelings are subconscious. We're not aware of them. The goal of our existence as human beings is to shine the light on that subconscious material, to bring what is hidden in the subconscious into the light of consciousness. That's how you understand yourself. That's how you evolve. That's how you grow. So,
sorry.
All the neurosciences scientists nowadays are saying, brain is malleable. We have been misled. We're thinking wrongly all this time. But we can change the brain. It's possible. It takes time. It takes persistence. But everything else in life, if you want to achieve anything, it takes persistence and willpower. So how do we rewire the brain? We go into the limbic system, which is our old brain, which is the emotional brain, and we do certain exercises. It's like very complex program designed to do exactly that. So you don't have to be a victim of your subconscious emotions and always be jerked into the same reactions. Yes?
Will you be leaving us with any sort of resources that we can then research on our own and have to do with the limbic system, for instance?
I could have given you a lot of resources, but I didn't think that anybody would ask that, so I didn't prepare them. However, I can tell you,
I will be teaching the course on sacred sites and earth energies in 2 weeks' time.
Perfect.
And then I can prepare all the resources you want. There are some flyers over there. And before you leave, if you have 3 minutes, I would like to show you my book trailer. I just finished the book trailer, and it was just a lot of work.
Yeah, that'd be a good way to end. Also, her website is on the board, so if you have a burning question for her, you can email her. I just volunteered that. But yeah, let's see if we can. Now I'm going to get the curtain really quick, so if you want to see this, it's really cool. It'll be the last thing.
So this is the book trailer that follows my spiritual travelogue, Meet Me in the Underworld, which is the result of my 6-year-long journey to those places I was telling you about, which I will be talking about in my course. And the book is out, and unfortunately I was a little bit late doing the book trailer, but better ever than never.
Is it on the internet as well?
It is on the internet, on YouTube, under my name, Svetlana Merritt.
Of 77 sacred sites, 770 cappuccinos, and 26,000 miles led me to my soul. A journey of soul searching through mythical places, mystical experiences, dangers and trials, love and laughter. From Belgrade to California, to Cyprus, to India, Egypt, Greece, Italy, and France, Svetlana Merritt takes us on a life-changing adventure she shared with her husband, Dwight Johnson. I kept asking myself this question: how do I find my true purpose in life? Why am I here? Meet Me in the Underworld is the story of a modern-day pilgrimage to world-famous sacred places and vortex sites. I had a recurrent dream. I'm standing on a cliff. To get to the other side, I have to jump over the abyss. As she searches for her mission in life, Svetlana descends into the underworld of her own psyche, where she battles personal demons and fears. To reach the light, I had to first descend into darkness. This story of inner transformation unfolds as Svetlana and Dwight follow the currents of earth energies through ancient sanctuaries.
Joseph Campbell showed us the inner wonders of the heroic quest. Now, Svetlana Merritt gives us an enchanting personal account of the initiatory mysteries. And so, my journey began. It was as simple as that, and as complex.